Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Friday, July 25th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, The Politics of Healthcare, Session 5 of Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
The system of healthcare we have in the country and pressures, directions facing, and my thoughts on how we ought to be working aggressively reforming it. And certainly healthcare reform has been on political agenda for many years. I think Bill Clinton's one was the last major attempt at a major restructuring of how healthcare is done. And it's, I think what most people remember of it was they presented it in 2 900-page books or something trying to explain a very complicated system. And as our healthcare systems get more complicated, most of the solutions get more complicated, which I would argue makes them not more politically feasible, but less so. I'll give a couple of statistics at the beginning from Minnesota, which is what I see most directly, but I know most of the rest of the country's got bigger problems than Minnesota in healthcare. In 2001, our state government estimated that just over 5% or just over 250,000 people Minnesotans were without health care coverage. The federal government's estimates for our state were significantly higher. They estimated just under 8% of the state's population was insured, uninsured, and that's 400,000 people roughly who were without health insurance. By contrast, the federal government's estimates nationwide are about twice that high of a rate, about 1 in 6 Americans not having basic health care coverage. And when you look at what's happening in most states like Minnesota right now, there was an attempt about 12 or 13 years ago, a state attempt, and many of the health care reforms or other ways of dealing with the system happened at the state level. Minnesota budget cuts last year, this past session, estimated 70,000 more Minnesotans will be without health care coverage. These are estimates. It's hard to tell because they shut down a program we had for very, very low-income adults without families, which most states got rid of a few years ago. If you are poor and you don't have kids, you're not a family, or you're not a senior, most states dropped health care coverage several years ago. Minnesota dropped the program that covered them and said, well, we have this state-subsidized health insurance program that will allow them to qualify for that. But people who have annual incomes, very low annual incomes, can't really afford to pay the co-payments for that plan, so and the enrollment fees for it, so they're going to do without health care. So I think the number is likely to be the high end of what the state's estimates were of the people falling off of it. We talk about our health care system in this country. I think there is good to say we've got some very great things going for us. We got, without question, the world's best technology, medical technology, the best knowledge base, I think, best researchers. We've got some of the best trained providers in the world. We may be slipping in certain areas where we haven't been like registered nurses. We have not been providing funding for them, and there are fewer and fewer of them. And some other countries do a much more aggressive job at providing it, recruiting enough nurses. And so we have some gaps in our system, but bottom line is I think we have the best possible health care for those who have access to it. We have it available. But despite that, again, as I said, 1 in 6 Americans doesn't have health insurance, and as a result of that and some other things we do poorly, we have a life expectancy that, while better than poorer countries, certainly, we're far from the top of industrialized nations in life expectancy. Child mortality, we do much worse than others. And when we're spending virtually twice what any other country is spending per capita on healthcare, we should be at the top of the charts in those areas. And it's largely because our system is very inefficient. We spend a lot more for what we get. And that's not to say that new technology and other things cheap, because it's not. It's just we waste a lot of money in other parts in the healthcare system. First talk about issues like providing healthcare as being something that government might be involved in, I think, was the 1930s with the New Deal. deal is a promise, a commitment to the social compact that we're going to make sure that people have a basic minimum. They're going to have basic necessities. The homelessness problem, poverty, seniors living in poverty particularly, those were all being addressed those years, though some of the medical portions didn't take effect till the 1960s with Medicaid and Medicare, and which were big steps forward, though they were not a commitment to cover everyone, and they're ones that have been slowly getting chipped away at. And I mean, Medicare doesn't do it. I mean, virtually any senior who can afford it has Medicare supplement coverage, and even that doesn't cover in many states, I know, so it doesn't cover prescription drugs. So the gap is far, and most industrialized nations surpassed us. The standard fee for service system of health care that we've had, you go to the doctor, you pay the bills. If you have health insurance, you pay maybe 20%, they pay 80%. There have been plenty of varieties, alternatives to that offered. We happen to be members of was initially in the 1960s, I think, the first HMO, first managed care system. I think the concept of that was great. I know a person who moved to Minnesota, was a director of the medical program for the Peace Corps in the 1960s, and moved to Minnesota to participate in this new concept of healthcare, where you're going to manage the care, which I think is a great concept. It's you bring people together, I meet with my doctors and talk with my doctors about how to not just deal with it when I've got had a heart attack, but how you prevent me from getting a heart attack in the first place. That concept has been sort of hijacked or corrupted perhaps in a way that now managed care often means managing ways to deny care, and a number of, I think some people call them gatekeepers. You gotta go to your family practice physician or a nurse or somebody else before you get a referral to somebody else, and you have to do all these other things before you get a referral. I sometimes think we're spending more money on determining whether you need this specialized care than giving it to you right up front, which is a big debate in the healthcare field, but we clearly spend a lot on the gatekeepers. And there was a big story, there was a HBO movie a year or two ago that talked about, I think it was called Damaged Care, talked about a woman who was a doctor who was doing reviews, medical necessity reviews for Humana, which is one of the largest healthcare, health insurance things in the country. And she had, this woman had denied, because that's what the plan said, denied a heart transplant to a patient who doctor said they needed it in order to live. And she said, nope, I can't get it. And the patient died, and the patient's doctor called her a murderer. And she started having second thoughts about what she was doing, and left the health plan. And prior to leaving the health plan, she had been told that the health plan on the corporate headquarters had a beautiful sculpture by Alberto Giacometti, the guy who does real thin iron stick figures. And they paid, she said, about $500,000 for one of these. And she said, that's how much my patients, this guy's heart transplant would have cost. They chose to get the artwork instead of providing the coverage. And anyhow, this spring or last winter, big news story about how they were suing her to find, she had found out later from some undisclosed source that the sculpture was actually $3.8 million. So she started giving talks. She's been talking about these issues. She gave talks in which she was saying that Humana bought the sculpture, denying 8 people their chance for a life-giving heart transplant. And so one of the attorneys for Humana, who happened to hear her saying this, and say that it was $3.8 million sculpture, wanted in a court case, he was facing her in several court cases where she was representing people denied, or she was not representing them, but testifying on their behalf. It got a judge to issue a contempt of court order saying, you got to disclose who gave you this confidential information. Where'd you find out it cost $3.8 million? Anyhow, it was finally, they said she was going to serve 6 months in jail if she didn't disclose it by the next Monday or something. She did disclose it. It was a guy who worked for, happened to be the brother of the CEO of Humana, which was an interesting their family dynamics must be quite interesting after that came up. But she was trying to protect him. He happened to be a neighbor of hers and a friend of hers, and disclosed to her it was actually $3.8 million for the sculpture. And they were trying to silence her because she's been saying they're denying care to people who need care. Anyway, the concept of managed care is a good concept, but basically a lot of seniors who are being pushed into it are saying, look, it's not managed care, it's managed denial of care. And so our system now isn't really a health care system, it's a non-system. We buy our health insurance various ways. I get mine through employer paid, I have to pay co-payments and part of the premiums, but basically it's employer provided. A lot of people don't have employer provided, and they're either self-employed or unemployed or whatever, and they somehow or another go shop for health insurance on their own. That's a growing, declining number of people. Then there's government provided health care. I mean, the main sources are employer provided, government provided, which seems to fall in. It tends to be the elderly with medical assistance, medical care, medical assistance, Medicare. Medical assistance covers the poor, some of the poor. People who are uninsurable because they've got cancer. Minnesota has a program, a government program that helps them get insurance when if you've had cancer and you're trying to buy it on your own, you can't buy insurance at any price. So they have a plan for that. And then frankly, some other people's health insurance is non-existent, so they get their health care in emergency rooms when they desperately need it. So people get it various sources, and it comes in. Two main sources are the traditional fee for service. You go to the doctor, they bill a certain amount, your insurance pays some, you pay some. Or the HMO concept where you pay a certain amount per person. What are the problems with what we've got now? Well, I mentioned earlier the 1 in 6 Americans not having any insurance. That includes a lot of working people, including a lot of people who work in the healthcare field. Nursing home employees in Minnesota, wages are low enough that very few of them have health care coverage. Working people without health insurance, anybody who's working part-time jobs generally doesn't have it. And then the next thing is the incomplete coverage. I mean, my plan is very good. I hate to think how much we're paying in co-payments this year because they've increased all the co-payments and we've had a lot of bills, including some orthodontist bills and so on. But we have orthodontic coverage. Most people don't. And for that matter, dental coverage is always an option. I've always wondered why our teeth are less important in our healthcare system than our toes or our fingers or some other parts of the body that are covered. It's determined because it's a different type of healthcare. That's not part of ordinary healthcare coverage. That's an add-on that some employers, not many, provide. And with the new stuff about how tooth decay can lead to heart disease, I think we should be seeing it as part of the whole person. And for that matter, mental health, chemical dependency. Is our mind less important than our heart? I don't think so. And yet, most insurance plans in most states provide very little mental health coverage, usually crisis stuff. When you have an absolute breakdown, they'll take care of it, acute care, but not anything preventive in mental health. Another problem that I think many people I've seen have is the shifting, the lack of continuity of care. Either you switch jobs, you get laid off, your employer switches health plans, or the insurance plan you're in switches doctors that are in the plan. And overnight, the doctor who you've got a 10-year history with is no longer your doctor. The only problem we've ever had with that was our health plan switched hospitals they covered. So the hospital we knew from I had surgery there once, both their kids were born there once, everything else. That's no longer it. And the people who work there, well, that's in a different health plan now. And so we haven't had family practice doctors or the ones actually treating us do it, but I see a lot of people who have somebody who helped figure out a very complicated problem and how to treat it, and they've been under their care for a long time, and overnight they switch doctors and they start from scratch. Cost shifting is a major one. You know, when you go to hospital and if you get an itemized bill, which fee for service people still do, I think if you take a Tylenol, if you're not under prescription coverage, if you get some minor thing like that, you look at the bill for it, it might be $20. costs there are hospitals ripping off. A lot of hospitals are struggling to keep afloat, but they have a lot of uncompensated care. This year, part of Minnesota's healthcare reform was, again, for the people under the Minnesota Care, our reform of 15 years ago, was to say, we're going to cap hospital bills at a certain amount, and we're going to have a co-payment if you're hospitalized, which, again, most people aren't, but if you're hospitalized, you have a co-payment of $1,000. Most people in this program don't have $1,000. And bottom line is they're still going to get the care, but the hospital is going to have to eat the $1,000 that they're not reimbursed for. And how do they eat the $1,000? Well, they charge everybody else for it. And cost shifting is a major problem, and it does increase everybody else's cost. Then the single biggest cost in our healthcare system, which most other countries don't have, is the bureaucratic paperwork shuffle. I know when first time we came here with our family, our daughter was 2 and a half, I think, and Connie was swinging around during some of the Beanie songs singing in the cafeteria, and she dislocated her elbow. And there was a nurse in the village who said, I could pop that right in, it should be no problem, but if there's a nerve pinched in there, you could destroy her arm, so you ought to have an x-ray. And so we raced her down. They had a special ride down to the dock because the boat hadn't left yet, and we got on the boat and spent the night in Chelan. The clinic there took a quick x-ray, it was fine. The doctor pops it in, puts a sling around. It took, well, a minute or two for the x-ray and a minute for the doctor to pop it in place and put the sling on. And we got three bills, one from the clinic, one from the x-ray lab, and one from the doctor. They totaled, and this is 15 years ago, I remember, they totaled about $200. And they sent us all the bills, and our health plan said what you were supposed to do when we get the bills. We're supposed to send them to them, explain what it is if there was lack of explanation, but send them the bills, and then they would review them. They'd pay 80%, and we'd pay 20%, because it was out of our area, and that's what our payment is. And they put it in their process, and it didn't happen quite quick enough, so we get another bill from the clinic and the doctor and the hospital, all of them separate bills, the clinic and the x-ray lab, and we forwarded them. And we got a third set of them, and by this time they had paid them, and then we pay our 20%, but one of the three bills had gone to a collection agency by that time because it took 2 months or something, and it was beyond their date. So then we're trying to straighten it out with the collection agency and everyone, and when you figure out how much it costs a business to send a letter home, a billing letter, not the postage, but all the processing time and everything else, there must have been, not counting our costs, but just our health insurer and the clinic and the x-ray lab and the doctor, there probably were, I would not be surprised if it was $60 or $70 worth of billing expense. And if you look at the overall picture, how much we spend is well over a quarter of every healthcare dollar we now spend on care. And I've seen, I know a woman who had mental health coverage in Rochester, Minnesota, at the Mayo Clinic, and she was from another county, and they'd send her there, and was being covered there, but then her county said after 3 months she wasn't covered, so then they'd send her home, and then she'd act up again right before she had gotten it under control, and keep shifting back and forth, and if the county won't pay for it, who does? And the clinic ends up paying for some. It's a terrible mess where we're spending a lot of money on totally unproductive paperwork stuff. And when Connie's grandmother was dying in her 90s, I remember trying to figure out her insurance papers. There's no way in the world she could have figured them out. The mistakes in payment of that, the time the person who's sick and struggling themselves has to spend on that is counterproductive. And but that's more than a quarter of the system, not counting the patient's time filling out the forms, just counting the insurance and the doctor and their end of the paperwork shuffle. And then finally, our system has very poor prevention, which leads to higher costs and other problems. Again, you don't treat mental health. Mental health is not a cause of crime directly, but I mean, certain types of mental health, people who are psychotic and so on, who don't get help, cost the system through crime. Chemical dependency untreated causes problems with crime. It causes all these problems cause a lot of other impacts, such as education, kids not being attentive in school because they've got other issues. But the cost alone goes fast. There was a column in the Minneapolis paper a couple months ago from a doctor who said last week she was arguing for universal health coverage. Last week she had two patients. One was an 8-year-old girl who had urinary tract infections, common ones, repeated though, and they didn't know the cause of it. Her father had health care coverage, but they couldn't afford the premiums for the dependent coverage. And so so it was too expensive for them to pay for an ultrasound or the other tests, and the doctor saying this can easily lead to structural bladder problems, or to or a large kidney stone could be one of the problems. She said either of them could have been things fixed easily, but they couldn't, they didn't have the money for it. They said if this continues, this girl could well have permanent kidney failure, which means lifetime of dialysis or kidney transplant, all of which are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we will pay for that eventually. The system will pay for it, and the public will largely pay through our cost shifting. And then the second example she gave was a 40-year-old woman who had two jobs and had health insurance at one of them, but she had hepatitis C, which it said she had gotten from her husband, who got it from a tattoo, and the only trouble was this woman had this diagnosed before she got her current health insurance. So it was a pre-existing condition, so we don't cover it. And this doctor said it would be treatable. It's not cheap to treat hepatitis C, but it would be a lot cheaper than what she'll ultimately face, which will be liver transplant. And we'll all pay for that. And so the cost shifting is not just in the form of I can't pay and therefore you're gonna pay more. It's also in the fact that we have people who use emergency rooms who wait till the crisis because they can't afford the preventive stuff. And finally, the gatekeepers causes delays in treatment. So I think there are a whole range of problems. I think we all understand them. What are the reforms being tried these days? One is weakened coverage. In business communities, I always saying we've got to drop all these mandates. That's what's driving up the cost. All these mandates of government for providing benefits cost a lot of money. Minnesota has a mandate that for childbirth, you can't kick the woman out of the hospital within 24 hours unless she feels she's okay and ready to go, because we have a lot of people turning them over the same day. So you can drop that mandate. You can drop dental care, as I mentioned. We don't have that as a mandate in Minnesota, but you can drop coverage. You don't have to provide this. You don't have to provide any transplants. Certain point, health insurance companies would love it if when we have to provide a bandage, if you need a bandage. But mandates, yeah, the more coverage you provide, the more it costs. I don't know what you are going to insure. If you just have no benefits, then it's free. So one of the schemes for reducing the cost or expanding coverage is to weaken the coverage that's available. Another one is higher co-payments. I mentioned earlier what happens if you have too high of co-payments, people don't get the care they need. And the whole assumption of higher co-payments are that people are apparently running off to see the doctor all the time. And there is a portion of the population that's term right now, but people always want to see the doctor. Hypochondriac, thank you. I don't think of myself as a hypochondriac. I'm scared of going to the doctor's office. I hate going to the doctor's office. I've been using it too much in recent years, but our co-pays went up significantly this year, and our utilization went up this year significantly because unrelated things. But that's one strategy for coping with it. Another one is purchasing pools. Helping small businesses get together. The largest businesses in Minnesota have formed purchasing pools where they're trying to form a massive purchasing pool. And that does fundamentally nothing to reduce insurer costs, to reduce provider costs, to reduce healthcare costs anyway, other than it's a pure and simple cost shift. If I can negotiate a better plan for my employees, then somebody else will negotiate a less good one. State covers a lot of people, state employees. We have a good plan and they negotiate pretty effectively. And so the health plans, all the individual coverage gets driven up higher as others get better coverage. But that's another solution that's being hyped. I don't think it fundamentally changes any of the problems. The final one I see a lot of is the medical savings account. It goes to the assumption you'll buy either no insurance or you'll have minimal coverage with very high deductibles. And then if you get sick, you'll take money out of your savings account. Trouble is most people who are uninsured or struggling to pay this, they don't have money to put in a savings account for medical purposes, and aren't going to, and again, that $1,000 co-payment for hospitalization under our state health plan, poor aren't going to have the money to put in a savings account for that. So what about real proposals to address it? I know of two that are being talked about these days, two types of them, one of which is to plug holes in the current system. One of Minnesota's senators got elected a couple years ago saying he was pushing for a universal health care system, employer provided. He was going to mandate employers do it, and for small employers who couldn't afford it, there'd be a government subsidy, and for people who weren't employed or other things, you'd plug in the holes here and there. I don't think that's a smart way to do it. We already have problems where a lot of people are in jobs that aren't really great for them, not jobs they're happy with, but I can't afford to leave my job because I have benefits here, and this other job I could do a better job at, they don't have benefits. So people, I think it's a real burden on business, the fact that people are choosing where they work, partly because of, or largely because of where their health benefits are. The sicker you are, the more you have to look for a job that has that kind of coverage. But I don't mind. I mean, if we're going to provide universal coverage to that approach, that seems fine. The other main approach is a universal health care system, such as what's been called a single-payer system, because it's government contracts with doctors and clinics, and frankly, good contract with HMOs, good contract with anybody to provide the services, and then we as citizens have our health care provided. When Bill Clinton came up with his complicated plan, which is more the first route, the patchwork, where those who are uninsured will provide a program to cover them to a certain extent. When he gave his plan, which was a compromise designed to make it passable, and he presented these books this thick and couldn't really explain it in 10 minutes what his plan would do, that destroyed all chance. It was easy for opponents to ridicule it and everything else. The only thing he did was smart about it, and it goes more to the other system, was he pulled out his wallet in the State of the Union address and said, you have a Social Security card, we want to give you a medical security card. And pulls out what was a prototype medical security card, and if you need health care, you're going to get the health care, we'll figure out the payment later kind of thing. And I think that's, you could do that with a patchwork of the current system, but frankly, it seems to fit more with the universal system, which most other industrial countries have some version of this. Everybody's covered through the same plan, and one of the advantages of it is members of Congress, for that member state matter, state legislators, people in power have the ability to get good plans, and a lot of the people we represent don't have any insurance. If we all have the same level of coverage, we're going to make sure, frankly, that it covers medical care. It's not going to be riddled with holes and, oh, you can't get care for this or care for that. But that's my preference. I think we should be going the route of a universal system because it gets rid of that 27-28% of the system that's bureaucratic paperwork. I think it helps to focus on prevention, which is, to me, the biggest single savings we can make in healthcare is if we focus on public health, on health prevention. But I like that approach, but that's not going anywhere. It's not getting anywhere at the national level, not getting anywhere at the state level, and oh, you want to be like Canada, and oh, how terrible it is. Well, Minnesota seniors a number of years ago on prescription drugs, which is a part of the picture here, Minnesotans Senior Federation was renting buses and shipping people to Canada because they get their drugs 40% cheaper on average. Sometimes 10 times as cheap, sometimes even slightly more expensive, depending on the drug. But average of 40% cheaper to get your drugs in Canada. So Minnesota seniors would rent buses. It was good hype for their effort to get drug price reform in the United States, but they were taking buses there. Well, I noticed about 3-4 years ago, the drug lobby started doing stuff on how don't pass these drug reforms that these groups are pushing for, because otherwise, you know, if you want to be like Canada, well, Canadians are getting on buses and coming here for care. And for certain types of non-essential care, the Canadian system is not being well funded, and they've got some growing problems in their system. But the whole point is the industry that likes what we have now, has a lot of money and very effective lobbying techniques, and they will very effectively criticize any plan that they'll say any failing in any system's healthcare, any other country's healthcare system. Oh, that's because it's a single payer or a universal healthcare system, and therefore we don't want to copy those mistakes. I don't want to copy anybody's mistakes. I want to learn from mistakes and do something better. So I've decided this past year, after watching how nothing happens, I'm throwing out another option that I'm hoping, if it doesn't happen in Minnesota, that somebody from some other state will copy. And that is, let's not talk about the details of the plan. Let's talk about the goals of the plan. So I drafted a bill and dropped it in this year, and I'm hoping to start hyping the idea in the next number of weeks and months and so on. But I introduced a bill that very simply all it did, it was a 5-page bill, and the first 3 pages described, put out what I call legislative findings. And if the legislature thinks they're not good findings, well, we can change them. Things such as all people deserve quality health care, an increasing number of Minnesota families unable to pay for covers, blah, 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 going through all the problems we have with our health care system. Just 3 pages of explanation of what the problem is, and then, okay, what are we going to do about it? We'll direct the Commissioner of Health, who's a Republican appointee, not somebody I would agree with necessarily on this, but appoint her to pull together a task force and give them a job. In the next 2 years, they have to pull together a plan for covering all Minnesotans. And if we don't want to cover all Minnesotans, we can oppose the plan. But I think the majority of Minnesotans, 80%+, believe all Minnesotans should have health care coverage. And so give the Commissioner of Health 2 years to pull together a plan, 2 or 3 years to pull together a plan to present to the legislature that will provide a universal health care system, and then spelling out a page and a half of requirements of what they should do. So then we have the debate over, do we want to have a plan that covers everyone? Now, there's some people who don't think it's the right thing to do. Do we look at the points I had? Ensures all Minnesotans receive comprehensive health care, highest quality available regardless of income. Allows patients ability to choose their own providers. Focuses on preventive care and early intervention to improve health and reduce later costs for untreated illnesses and diseases. Provide comprehensive benefits, including all coverage currently required by law, complete mental health services, chemical dependency treatment, prescription drugs, medical equipment, dental care, long-term care, and home care services. Continues promoting Minnesota's leadership in medical education, training, research. That's one concern, that we don't set aside the medical research and training we have, because frankly, we're doing it now, we're cutting it back. There's an association of teaching hospitals in Minnesota, probably every other state. And the residency training for physicians, fewer and fewer hospitals are willing to do it because the cost of training is great. And same thing with medical research, most of which is not paid through by our healthcare premiums, most of which is paid for by pharmaceutical companies and manufacturers, or frankly by federal government grants. But then insurers, other requirements would ensure enough qualified people in every part of the state, because a lot of rural communities can't get clinics, can't get the help they need. Doesn't restrict or deny care or reduce the quality of care in effort to hold down costs. I think if we don't spell out issues like that, you're not gonna get anywhere. Provide adequate and timely payment to providers. Government is really good at, when they're trying to save money, just refuse to pay bills. And then fund it through premiums or other payments based on citizens' ability to pay, so as not to deny care to somebody because of income. And so I spelled out these 9 items, and in effect, you know, our senator who had come in proposing to have employer-based care, I don't think that makes as much sense as another universal system does, but know, if somebody doesn't like this system, then let them propose one that'll do it, but let's figure out what the parameters are of what's acceptable. And then you can have a debate. Some people would say we shouldn't have a progressively funded based on ability to pay. They should say, no, it should be flat payments. Well, then how are you gonna make sure that low-income folks are able to pay the bills? Maybe we shouldn't focus on prevention. I can't picture a lot of people arguing that one. But I would propose that most of these items are ones that would have vast public support. And then, you know, let the experts, let the task force I called for in the legislation would be made up of I didn't put medical insurance providers in there. I didn't put health plans, things like that. I put in medical providers, patients, representatives of employers and employees. They come together, and the commissioner can bring in anybody else she feels fit. But let them wrestle with it. Let the people who study the issue, the people who deal with it, let them do it, but spell out the parameters, because I've signed on as a co-author of a single-payer bill in the past, and if you try and look at the bill, the average citizen looks at the bill, what the heck does this mean? And it's been hard to get hearings on them. And I think what we have to do is start changing the debate so we get to the point where citizens get to say what they want covered. And because, as I said, we are paying, I think the U.S. per capita is actually more like three times what most industrialized countries pay. Canada is a little over half what we pay per capita. And they've been cutting back a lot in recent years. But I think the system is deteriorating enough that we've got to, let's start talking about the goals rather than the specifics. And once we agree on the goals, now put people together in a room, say you figure it out, and here's what we're going to do then. And it's a radical shift. The health lobbying at the Capitol, we spend hours tweaking a little thing. The public hospitals in the Twin Cities were very concerned that the health care reform this year, or the budget cuts more likely, were going to have a major impact on their ability. Some rural hospitals think they're going to be shutting down. I had one doctor who's active in the universal health care movement who said that, he told me a couple years ago, he thought we were going to get universal health care quicker than he once thought. Why? He thinks the system is crumbling faster than people realize. And anyhow, that's my proposal, and I didn't mean to spend this long talking about it, but I guess I'd like to get feedback and comments on, does this have any promise? Or is this kind of a, well, sure, you can say, hey, we'll together a task force, nothing's going to happen, but nothing's happening now. Go ahead, Andrew.
You may have mentioned before I got in, but I heard you talk about the costs built in because of administrative issues. My impression is that a huge reason for the ongoing increases in the system is because of litigation and the incredible insurance costs that physicians and hospitals bear, et cetera, et cetera. Is one of the goals you're including some way to limit?
Sure. In terms of, I don't have a big problem. There was a student here who left yesterday or the day before who was doing a paper on this for us. She's apparently in a summer course. And somebody hooked her up with me to talk for a little while about the issue, about medical cost liability things. And by the way, there are a whole range of things that drive up the cost of this, including marketing, because every health plan has to be making their sales pitch to every large employer every year. They have to make a pitch, because otherwise you drop a, if state of Minnesota currently has three plans as options you can sign up with. And they've been changing. They dropped a couple of them a couple of years ago. If you're one of those plans and you lose access to tens of thousands of employees, you may end up raising your costs enough that you lose all your other customers too. So their marketing is a major factor in the cost. Insurance, liability insurance is definitely a factor in how this works out. I told the student the other day that I'm not sure that the states where they've capped liability have seen premiums go down. Minnesota capped costs for workers' compensation insurance a number of years ago, and premiums didn't really decline. Part of the issue is insurance industry, its self-interest is to provide as little benefit as it can and be able to charge as much as it can. I mean, that's, if they can't charge enough for the costs, they're going to go belly up, so they have to be able to do that. And certainly some states, New Jersey I think it is having a severe problem with OBGYNs, which is very high medical malpractice issues. I'm not sure, watching what happens when states do try and do this, that it's the best way to do it. And often, I think if we had a flat-out system that this is the expectation of how we do things, you can have some ability to con- control of that, but I know the product liability, limitation on liability, the insurance stories about, oh, this horror story where a jury awarded $10 million for some, the McDonald's hot coffee case. When I read more about it, I mean, it sounded bizarre to me when I heard why they did it. It was kind of like the Pinto case. McDonald's was intentionally saving money by brewing coffee much hotter than people drink it because you milk more coffee out of the bean. And so this woman who had second or third degree burns on her legs when cups spilled on her, they said, you know, the jury heard how they got papers from McDonald's saying we are brewing it hotter because we can save money doing this. And yes, people burn themselves, but the insurance costs of that are less than this. But the Pinto decision on the Bolt's puncturing gas tanks, it costs more to fix that than to pay out the insurance claims. The jury hears that and they say, we're going to just kill this person, we're going to send them to the cleaners, and large punitive damages. Punitive damages, I think, shouldn't go to attorneys. I think we could change that so it goes to the system, to the public, where the public is the one who should be beneficiaries of the punishment. The federal government's trying to limit that right now. The House passed it, the Senate hasn't. But there was that woman in Minnesota who, I think it was a Wisconsin woman, may have made national news because this woman was from Washington and she had heard about it. Woman who had a double mastectomy because the hospital goofed and gave it to the wrong person. And she probably won't suffer any physical complications from that. The maximum under the federal law was gonna be $250,000 for pain and suffering. I think that's the cap they had. And is that fair? Is that enough? If I thought it was gonna really bring down premiums, I'd say that. I think we've got a real problem in insurance right now in a number of fields. I don't like our tort system, our legal system that way. I'm not sure what's a better system though. And usually capping one side without doing anything to the other side, I'm not wildly enthused about it. I'm open to the arguments on it. But usually when I see it done, I don't see a lot of reduction in premiums, which makes me wonder where it is, why it's happening that way. But it is certainly a factor, and I think we can't, that's gotta be part of how we look at saving costs. Because for a doctor, if a doctor's paying some OBGYNs, I think it's several thousand bucks a year. And $8,000-$9,000 is a lot of money. And that adds to the cost. It's a factor that shouldn't be ignored.
Is Vermont the only state that has universal health care?
They don't.
Nobody really has.
Okay. No state has it. Minnesota, as I said at the beginning, is about half the, according to federal government estimates, we're about half the number of uninsured. We're about, by their estimates, almost just under 8% uninsured. Nationwide, it's about twice that. But no state has a full system. And the way Minnesota and Vermont and other states do it is, well, we'll plug in for these low-income folks who don't qualify for medical assistance because they have jobs, they're working, well, we'll give them this system, but no state has it. And virtually every other industrialized country, Japan, Europe, so on, all have a universal system of one sort or another. Largely, the concept of a single payer where, like Social Security, only instead of Social Security check going to you, Social Security, the medical security check goes to the doctor, the clinic, or the whoever is providing the service.
I don't know if I can articulate this question, or if it's really just not even a question, but the proposals for universal health care on a federal level are killed mostly. Is it more AMA driven or HMOs or a combination of, or are they in league together or?
Everybody.
Really, who really puts the kibosh on
it? It's not one person. It's some of it's philosophical. Oh, I don't want government into this. Government's always inefficient. Social Security is about the most efficient thing we have because what they do is they write checks out to people and it's 1-2% rate of percent going to administrative costs, very minimal administrative costs for something like that. Doctors, AMA wouldn't talk about it, though they've had at recent AMA conventions, they've actually voted on whether we should be considering a universal healthcare system and a growing number of doctors are seeing it. Again, this one doctor that I told the story about earlier at Humana, who called the Humana doctor a murderer, they see their patients dying, they see this happening. More and more doctors are getting, what's the solution? They're not sure exactly what it is, but they know what we have is not working. So AMA has been much more open than 20 years ago on this. The health insurance plans, especially the for-profit ones, Minnesota HMOs and Blue Cross and so on, they're not-for-profit, which when you see your Minnesotans, you see the Attorney General going after some of the outrageous expenses they have and some of the payouts, the benefits they've given to some of their executives, which are, I think, frankly, outrageous. You compare that to the for-profit systems, where there's no cap on anything. They fight it hard. They fight it very hard. One thing that's surprising to me is that the United States business community isn't more aggressive in saying, we don't want it on employer-based, we want something else. Because when American auto manufacturers were losing ground to Japan and 20, 30 years ago, Japan and European countries, they pay taxes for their health care. We include it in the price of the cars, and if you want to talk about unfair trade practices, well, we are slapping on an extra burden on our manufacturers. They're not going to sell cars there. I think an estimate is 10% of the cost of an American automobile or more goes into health care for the employees, because it's not just the employees of the manufacturers itself, but all their suppliers. It's a very major cost, and I'm surprised the business community isn't more aggressive saying, you know, we can't get employees without offering the benefits, and we can't afford to offer the benefits. And it's a messed up system.
I think just like putting a cap on one end doesn't work. If you went to a universal health care plan, the automakers are not going to reduce the price of their car by $10,000.
Right.
They're going to see we can make more money.
Except the one advantage you have, though, is in a system. I mean, there's some areas where, I mean, those prescription drugs, we have the most dysfunctional market in prescription drugs of any product that I know. Healthcare, it's very hard to have a competitive healthcare thing. I remember the fad was Minnesota is in a system where we're supposed to be grading all of our health plans and hospitals, and federal government, I think, actually passed something on that, too. So people have it. Consumers have an ability to choose which is the best provider. Well, how in the world am I, even if I had a choice of two providers, and this one's a little cheaper, but this one's got better rates for heart disease and so on, when you're covering 50,000 different types of illnesses and different types of treatments, and how in the world do you judge? Being an informed consumer doesn't help in that case, in terms of which comprehensive health plan am I going to turn to. With auto manufacturers and others, you know, there is some price sensitivity where people, you know, if I can buy a car cheaper from Ford than for General Motors, that's roughly equivalent car in my mind, I'm going to buy the cheaper one. And if they can knock down the prices, it's not going to happen. There's no guarantee that that will happen. There is some competitive pressure. And frankly, as our automakers have lost ground for many years, I think they're more stable now. Lost ground to foreign manufacturers, it's the case. But yeah, there's no guarantee if we drop employer coverage that they're going to bring down their prices, because they will do everything they can not to. The same as with insurance. It's sensible for an employer to try and reduce their costs any way they can and not reduce their prices. So it doesn't happen as a guarantee. yes.
I'm really excited about your bill and happy that there are people who aren't giving up on universal care, because, you know, it feels often as if there's just sort of this, you know, oh, well, I guess it's not.
We can't do anything.
Yeah, we can't do it. It's too expensive. But, and so, I mean, I can't give you a lot of feedback about the way you've designed it, because I don't know that much about the legislative process and what has happened in the past, but I do have a question about the prescription drug companies, because my mom was complaining about her drugs, and I said, well, you know, we could try to, you know, get you some from Canada, or, you know, work on online or whatever. And then it turned out that the drug company was giving them this huge discount, which they got through their, you know, applied through their doctor. And I've heard of others getting that, and I was curious about that. And how the drug companies, if that's a way for them to win just support for the current system the way it is. And also, I was wondering, you know, if they actually are able to write off those costs, and if that's ethical. I mean, are they pumping up their prices and then giving a discount and writing it off?
Well, the biggest problem with the discounts that they give through doctors, where you can get, if you're low income, sometimes you can get free prescriptions that way. The difficulty with that is, I've talked to seniors who say they change their, you have to reapply every 3 months, you have to do this. Every manufacturer has its own rules. They cover very few people, and most people, you fill out all the forms and you find out you don't qualify. So it covers very, very, very few people as a percentage of those who are without it. And yes, I'm sure they can probably write off anything they give for free or reduced level. The biggest problem with the prescription drug industry is the lack of competition in it. And they don't need competition, they don't want competition, they lobby the US Congress, they extend their patents as long as they need to. We had a doctor at Mayo Clinic a few years ago who got active in the prescription drug field because he, I believe he was a cardiologist dealing with heart patients, and he had found some medication that we use for veterinary medicine, I think it was for sheep. He found out it was wonderful for humans. And he had gotten permission from FDA to try it, and it was so effective. He started hyping to get this approved for humans across the board because, just on his own, because he said this was so valuable. Well, the manufacturer who made the sheep medication now makes it for people, and what was $14 prescription or dose, what you could get for $14 for sheep was like $350 for the human. Oh, the company had all this work, they have all these additional costs because they have to go through FDA approval. This doctor did most of the work at getting FDA approval, with nothing to do with the company. He didn't profit from it. He was doing it because he said it was a good drug for it. And he started testifying how outraged he was at what the company did to just jack up the price. And 10 years ago, well, in the last 10 years, the largest 10 generic drug manufacturers have been bought out, in every case by a name brand competitor. Why? Well, back 10, 15 years ago, when the first generic drug could hit the market after 17-year patent expired, first generic drug, the average price was about 65% of the new price. Now the average price of the first generic on the market is over 90%. Why? Well, they buy up their own competitors. And the Canadian price is not subsidized. If your mother bought drugs in Canada, it's not subsidized. They're making a profit in Canada. Matter of fact, if you get it through your health plan, our health plan, I pay right now a co-payment of $12 on each prescription, whether the drug, unless it's less than $12 for the prescription. If it's a $400 prescription for a monthly dose, I pay $12, and the health plan probably pays $200. So $212 for the $400 prescription. Trouble is half the public does not have, half in Minnesota, probably more elsewhere in the country, does not have prescription drug coverage. And for the half that doesn't have it, they don't negotiate the prices. And it's, I would argue that our health plans and hospitals get prices similar to Canada or Mexico or Europe for the same drugs, where they're making money off of them, but they're making a fair profit, not an excessive one. They're not, drug companies aren't stupid, and they won't sell their drug for less than cost. But the chain drug stores, Walmart, Costco, Walgreens, all those, a few years ago they had a major lawsuit. The lawyers for the small pharmacies sold out and settled, but the large ones kept fighting because they said, we're paying so much more. And they had documented Inderol, a heart medication. They paid $48 and something for a certain supply of it. They said some of the HMOs they could document were getting it for $4 and something cents. These are the large chains. It's not volume here. They're charging 12 times as much, the large purchasers, as the others. Why? Because the health plans say, you offer our drug and none of our competitors will give you the discount, the rebate. They call them rebates. I call them kickbacks because they're undisclosed. We can't document what they are. We can find out once in a while what they are. But 12-to-1 price differential, I think we should have Canada negotiates their prices. And they're not going to, no drug manufacturer is going to sell them below cost. It's not in their interest to. But they do sell drugs in Canada 40% less on average. And to me, it's the biggest scam. I worked for several years on legislation on this. And what did they do then when people started importing drugs from Canada? They went to the FDA and started lobbying the FDA to say that that's unsafe. People could tamper with them. I have a doctor friend in Tucson who he and his wife were buying medications to try and do fertility medications. And they're very expensive. I mean, it's like $500 a month here. And they were getting them for a fourth that price. They would cross the border, which is an easy drive away, cross the border, buy the identical drug there, same manufacturer. Instructions might be in Spanish, but that's not hard to take care of. But a doctor going to Mexico to get his own prescriptions, well, they could be tainted, you know, they could be. I mean, frankly, they could be tainted at my local pharmacy, too. But I would argue that it's the biggest scam in medicine right now is the pharmaceutical lobby, which pays, they tell you that they need all this money for research and development. Most of their research dollars are spent by federal grants.
And they spend
And
they spend far more on advertising.
On marketing and
research.
Advertising, yeah. Yeah, they wanted to be able to sell to us. I see these ads for Dorothy Hamill, the figure skater, using some medicine. I don't even know what the medicine's for. But, you know, all it is, oh, ask your doctor if this would be good for you. Well, she's in good shape, she's healthy, and boy, I want to be that way too. I'll ask my doctor, maybe this would be good for me. Direct marketing to consumers we didn't have years ago. Now you read Time Magazine and every 10th page is a full page ad. And that drives up the healthcare system. Yeah, you're right.
Drives doctors crazy too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors, the freebies, a lot of doctors have been complaining they may take advantage of someone, but they're driven crazy by the amount of visits from marketers.
They found one of these things with Claritin or something like that. Cost, you know, phenomenal price, and it's not any better than the aspirin or Aleve or whatever you've been taking all along.
And most of the pharmaceutical manufacturers' own research dollars, ones that aren't government or public dollar ones, their own are often similar copycat type of medications, which is not to say they're worthless, because Claritin might, in certain categories, might help people more than others, and you do make slight improvements, but that tied up with their marketing directly to consumers. Doctor, no, can you give me Claritin? I mean, I hear that's so good. And the doctors, you know, a doctor doesn't spend that long. And frankly, doctors, the marketing to doctors constantly, and every pad we have a doctor who gives us a ton of post-it notes on you name it, kind of everything from drug manufacturers, every pen they get, everything. And when doctor says take 2 Tylenol, well, I can't even pronounce it. Generic acetaminophen, acetaminophen, I can never pronounce it right, but it's easier to say Tylenol. Well, Tylenol tends to be more expensive than the generic ones, but that's only one part of the prescription drug racket, and I would describe it as a racket. I asked our attorney general, so you know, I said, I've been calling these things kickbacks, and I said, is that fair? And they said, well, we wouldn't use the term kickback because the implication is that it's illegal, even though the word kickback in the dictionary it means an undisclosed payment to another, whatever. Exactly what we think of as a kickback. It's not by definition illegal, though people have a sense it's bad. And so the attorney general's staff said, yeah, we tend not to use that term, but no, we could use the term. And yes, it is a kickback. It's not a rebate or whatever. Any system which relies on total consumer ignorance on price. You know, if I knew that Claritin, for instance, I don't even know what Claritin is for, allergy or what, but pain relief, but if I knew that the drug my doctor prescribed for me costs a fourth as much as Claritin and probably was 98% effective or 95% as effective, I'd probably say, yeah, doctor, even if I'm paying $12 either way, I'd rather you go the cheaper one. Give me the cheaper one. Because it's in my long-term interest to have the cheaper one. But I can't know how much they're paying because it's all confidential. The Blue Cross helped fight against my bill to require disclosure of the kickbacks. Why? Because they are under contract. They said, oh, the drug manufacturers say they will stop giving us, they'll stop providing us the lower prices if we disclose how much we're getting the lower prices. And I said, what a scam this is. I mean, we're going to, nothing is more government subsidized than pharmaceuticals, both in the research and in the purchases for people who can't afford it. And yet we won't allow anyone to know what the price is.
So John, you said a couple things. That one is that we pay three times right now in our non-system healthcare what other per capita.
But many countries, it's not that we don't get some things they don't get out of it, so I don't argue we should be.
And so my question would be where are we losing money in unproductively? You said paperwork?
Paperwork's a quarter of our entire cost.
You said malpractice insurance costs.
That would be
litigation.
Yeah, I would guess that could be 2-3% of, I don't know, that's just.
Pharmaceuticals?
Pharmaceuticals, we're way above others, yeah. I that's 40% above what other countries pay for it. And we may use more of it too. But
could possibly part of it also be the offering of procedures which are very expensive, which aren't offered in other places?
That's part of it too. And see, so in other words, I would not, and I don't want to argue that we should be cutting back on those, because I think we've been willing to pay 2-3 times what other countries pay now. If we can provide it, I think, for less money by getting rid of some of these other things.
Although
I
wouldn't want to argue that necessarily either, but a member of my church, congregation, who's 80-something, just had a 5 bypass surgery.
Yeah.
Now, that's extremely expensive.
End of life, the last month of your life,
right,
is where we spend
exactly
a ton of money. And I think that, often the patients aren't asking for that either. We have very little talk about that. I mean, Minnesota's had for 10 years or so now a living will type of thing. We filled out the forms, and before Connie and I have had surgery in the past, we talked over with each other what our expectations were and what we wanted in various cases, and basically was, don't give me a lot of things if I'm in this sort of situation. And we're younger folks. I think at age 75, 85, 90, we might be saying, well, even if this is the case, even if I could be restored to this, maybe don't do it. And that's not technically under our way of thinking. That's not in my self-interest. Well, I think in a sense it is, and I think people would. But end of care is very end of life care, those kind of procedures.
Well, I would agree. Most people, I'm a pastor, most people I deal with end of life.
Yeah.
The families and they themselves, generally, if they're able to make the decisions, will not choose to have expensive procedures. But if grandpa is not coherent and there is no living will,
then they have to do it.
The medical, they have to go ahead and spend.
And everything else, And I think that that's part of the education, the prevention, that's part of the whole, the managing of care, which is why I hate the fact that managing care has been so perverted from what I think it should mean. Because one other factor in terms of the biggest cost drivers are the lack of prevention. And that's not only in the tobacco and weight and other things, it's also in the fact that somebody who, I mean, the horror stories, you go to the emergency room, can end taping now if you will. The person who was told by her doctor, the medical assistance patient was told by her doctor she needed this medicine, but she couldn't afford the $25 at her local pharmacy. She knew she could get it if she went to the hospital. She took a cab to the hospital. No, she couldn't take a cab. She took an ambulance to the hospital. This was a horror story about 10 years ago. Got it. It probably cost the taxpayers $2,000 for a $17, $25 prescription. And emergency care, because you didn't prevent. To me, that is probably as big as the, probably not quite as big as the end of life issues.
You know, another area that I always wonder about, and it sort of relates to the litigation issue, but physicians routinely have way more tests than are necessary, and they know it, partly because of the litigation, and
right,
partly because their clinic and HMO says, run all the tests because we can collect more money for them.
Right. And by the way, thank you all for coming to this. I appreciate the chance to do this. But on that one, yes, I think they often, first of all, if anything goes wrong, they can always do it, and they bill for each particular test. and that's not a good way to do it.
No, they, I mean, a lot of these physicians know they're unnecessary tests,
mm-hmm.
and it drives them crazy to be ordering them, but they're caught.
They're told to do this. The other one is the biggest fight in Minnesota legislature this year on healthcare was between some, I think it's MRI type of technology, and two groups of doctors fighting for whether they can put in more of these things in, because one of them thinks they can drive out some of the other ones by putting more in, but you only need so many of these machines in a state because you can't ever pay for them all unless you have constant use. One group of doctors is trying to bring them in, the other group's trying to fight them. It's all in their own self-interest because they all get a cut of the ones they refer to there.
Yeah.
And that's nothing to do with improving anybody's health care.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an outrageous thing. And they both have some of the most expensive lobbyists at the state lobbying at the state legislature. And yeah, as you said, the fear of litigation on some things, education here would help a whole lot, not the litigation only, but it would help the end of life care. If we sat down and planned our healthcare system, we could do a lot better than we do. And you know, I wouldn't argue that we'd be a whole lot cheaper than we are now, but I would argue we'd be cheaper and we'd be better results.
About technology, I would just add too that I think that we have run past our ability to prove that the technology really leads to benefits.
Yeah.
The technology, the use of technology is way ahead of any evidence that
it
works.
I figured.
And it's not until it becomes ingrained and becomes part of the liability structure that there's even any outcome evidence that says, oh, wait a minute, never mind, that doesn't work anyway.
Yeah.
But we've spent billions of dollars. Electronic fetal monitoring during labor is one of those technologies that's been proven repeatedly not to improve outcomes.
Hmm.
But it's part of the standard of care because of liability.
And once you get standard of care, then once you get that this is the standard of care here, then anybody in any other community that doesn't do that, then
exactly.
they are more set up.
Then you set yourself up for liability.
Then you get the liability things because the jury's going to say, look, if everybody else is doing this, why aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, and liability issues just rise with the impersonalization of medical care.
Yeah.
Which has all come as a result of having to change providers every time your employer changes providers, so you have no trust.
Yeah, but
generates more.
Yeah.
Right. This week, I noticed a little kid around here, a 4 or 5 month old kid with a burned hand, and the whole concept. I mean, I asked what happened. Was it a restaurant went atchy and split pea soup was apparently too hot, and the kid touched his hand in and. Major burns. I mean, these apparently had wrapped up for a week or something. And I said, what'd the restaurant do? What'd you say to them? I said, well, I really got out of there so fast I got out of there so fast to get into the doctor, the hospital, emergency room, and they were all just kind of stunned before. And I said, did they apologize or anything like that? I was thinking, what's he going to do? And I said, well, are you going to do anything more about it? And I mean, what? I mean, he probably had very good grounds for a lawsuit, but he had no, I mean, it was clear he wasn't looking at that. He was just, you know, I think he'd love to make sure they don't make that kind of mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we sue because the more impersonal it is and the more somebody says, hey, why don't you sue?
Yeah, and the more trust.
We probably all have a number of things we could sue people on.
Yeah.
We might.
Well,
I think we as a culture want perfect outcomes.
Yeah, and we're not.
We want perfect outcomes. We've been promised it almost by this technological medical system.
Yeah.
If you do what I say and have all these tests and use all this technology, we should be able to keep you alive and make you
forever.
Well. And it's not happening.
Oh,
we can't do that. We're not God.
Yeah.
Okay. And the question tells you there's no such thing as an act of God because God can't pay off.
Thank you, Jennifer.